Well, welcome back. My name is Jeff Procise. I'm your presenter for the next hour and 15 minutes. And the subject of the presentation is Silverlight 5, all the cool new stuff in Silverlight 5. Before I begin, I want to give you a URL, which you can see here in this high-tech device called Notepad. I'm going to be showing you a lot of samples. If you would like a copy of these code samples for yourself, go to that URL at your convenience. You'll find a zip file there about 19 or 20 megabytes. And you, too, can have a copy of everything I'm showing. That same zip file also contains copies of the other demos I'll be showing tomorrow and the demos that I showed in Belgium earlier this week, some of which will not be shown here. So there's just lots and lots of good, cool Silverlight code there. Also some HTML5 code, if that interests you at all. It actually comes from tomorrow's talk on Silverlight versus HTML5. I'll put this URL back up at the end in case you didn't get a chance to copy it down. But since we only have a limited time together, I want to go ahead and get started by talking about all the cool new stuff in Silverlight 5. So, as you're probably aware, the first beta, maybe the only beta, of Silverlight 5 came out just a few days ago. It debuted at the Mix conference in Las Vegas. You may also know, if you follow that the beta is not feature complete. In fact, I'm going to talk at the end of this about what's not in the beta, but will be there later. But there's enough there that I can show you what I believe is some pretty cool stuff, hopefully something that you will find compelling. And I want to start with the little stuff and kind of work our way up to the bigger stuff. And the little stuff begins with text improvements. So every version of Silverlight up to now has made improvements to the text rendering engine. In the early days, for example, Silverlight didn't support text anti-aliasing. They added that, I believe, back in Silverlight 3. They made some additional enhancements in Silverlight 4. They're making even more and perhaps more significant enhancements to the text engine in Silverlight 5. One of the big pieces of news here is text overflow. Now, the rich text box control has been around since Silverlight 4. In fact, even before it was added to the runtime, it was part of the Silverlight toolkit. In version 4, it became part of the runtime itself. Silverlight 5 introduces a companion to the rich text box control called Rich Text Box Overflow. This feature is sometimes referred to as linked text or linked text boxes. Before I describe how it works semantically, let me say just a word about why the Silverlight team felt compelled to put this in there. A lot of us these days like to use various kinds of reader software to read content online. You may read the New York Times or your favorite magazine online. A lot of us find ourselves in the position of needing to build reader interfaces now. And oftentimes those reader interfaces call for multi-column text. Now, while it wasn't impossible to do multi-column text in earlier versions of Silverlight, there were certain things about it that were very difficult. In fact, if you wanted text to flow from one to another, perhaps in response to changes in font size, it was really, really hard to make that work. So in Silverlight 5, if you want to do reader-type interfaces with multi-column text, it becomes incredibly easy to do. You begin with a rich text box control that shows, let's say, column 1. Then, if you want to present a column 2, you declare a rich text box overflow control, and you use the new overflow text content property of rich text box to connect it to that rich text box overflow control. Now, anything that won't fit inside the rich text box automatically spills over, font properties and all, to the rich text box overflow control. And by the way, if you wanted to make this a three-column layout rather than two-column, you just declare another rich text box overflow control and link the first rich text box overflow to the second. I'll show you this in a moment, and I think you'll agree that it couldn't be a whole lot easier. Syntactically, here's how it works. In this simple example, I've declared a rich text box control. Let's say that comprises column 1 of the interface that we're building. But for column 2, I've declared a rich text box overflow control. And you can clearly see the overflow content target property there, which is pointing the rich text box to the rich text box overflow control. Now, while the team was at it, they decided to do more with text as well. Another thing we've never really been able to do in Silverlight is control font leading. to control spacing between characters. If I wanted to do that, if I wanted control over typography in earlier versions, I usually ended up using glyphs to do that. And you may know firsthand that when you put 10 or 20,000 glyphs on that page, the performance probably isn't what you hoped it would be. Well, it couldn't be easier today, because in Silverlight 5, rich text box and other text input elements have a new property named character spacing. If you want wider character spacing, you just set it to some number like 100 or 200, or you can do it interactively, as I'm about to do right here. So let me show you a quick demo showing off some of these improvements to the text engine. And this first one is one of those that's in the zip file whose URL I gave you a few moments ago. Let's go find it. This will be under my Silverlight 5 samples. And this one is called Text Overflow Demo, where I built a simple reader interface for an online publication which I totally made up called the Daily Plugin. See if we can get it running there. Here we go. Looks like it's going to work. So here is the Daily Plugin. Looks a little bit like a newspaper. You may notice that there are a couple of slider controls down here. One of these slider controls I've bound to the font size property of the rich text box control that you see over here on the left. What you see on the right is actually a rich text box overflow control, and yes, the two of them are bound together. When I move this slider to increase the font size, notice how well, how easily and how performantly that text just flows from the left to the right. In terms of leading or character spacing, I have a second slider control here, which in this case is bound to the character space property or character spacing property of this rich text box on the left. As I move it, you'll see the distance between characters increase. And you can also see, since that's affecting the volume of the text, how it easily flows from one to the other. So the truth is, if you're not interested in this kind of interface, you may not need these features, but if you're one of those individuals or one of those companies who wants to build interfaces with this type of typography, it couldn't be a whole lot easier than it is right here. And in fact, if you look behind the scenes and you look at the XAML that makes this thing work, you'll find that, well, if I can do it, anybody can do it. Let me just show you. Here is the rich text box control displaying the column on the left. You see I even named it column 1. Here is the rich text box overflow control that's comprising column 2. And to bind the two together, I'm doing exactly what I did in the slide. I use the new overflow content target property of rich text box. Use a little bit of data binding here to bind to that rich text box overflow control. So that is a quick look at what is present in the beta with regard to typography in Silverlight 5. There are additional text enhancements coming post-beta. So, let's move on to the next area of enhancements, which are some improvements to the media handling in Silverlight. I wrote an application a long time ago and published. It was originally a Silverlight 2 application. I've upgraded a few times. But it uses sound effects. It basically shows the user an old teletype style typewriter keyboard. And as the user clicks those buttons with the mouse, I make little clicking sounds to make it seem as if they're typing on a typewriter. But there are certain aspects of that application that never worked right. In the old days, the only way I had to produce that sound effect was to use a media element control. Unfortunately, media element doesn't guarantee me that there will be no latency between the time I call play on it and the sound effect actually plays. And what I found most of the time was that the very first time I call played on that media element, it was up to a second or so before the sound effect actually played. So Silverlight 5 borrows a trick from Silverlight for Windows Phone, which integrates parts of Microsoft's XNA framework. We now have an XNA sound effect class in Silverlight 5, specifically for doing low latency sound. I'll show you how this thing works. The API is rich, but it's also very, very simple to use. There's also a new feature coming, and I say coming because it's half there in the beta and half not, called Trick Play. One of the things that's been missing from Media Element for a long time, and I've had a lot of customers say to me, boy, I wish that the Silverlight team would add this in, is the ability to control the playback rate of a video or even an audio in a media element. Well, good news, in Silverlight 5, the media element control has a property named playback rate. If you want to do a slow motion playback, you set that property to 0.5. If you want to double the speed of the playback, you change it to 2. But here's what's really cool about it. Audio pitch correction. You know how when you speed up a video to twice its normal speed, the sound gets distorted. It makes everyone talking, for example, sound like Alvin and the Chipmunks. Or if you slow it down, play it at half speed, the audio becomes warbled. With trick play and with audio pitch correction, when you change the playback speed of that video, the sound will not be changed. Now, that part of it isn't present in the beta yet, but it will be there post-beta, and I'm really looking forward to that. One other little trick they pulled out of the playbook here is that they have added support for a GPU decoding of frames in H.264 videos. Now, if you deal with H.264 video, you know that it tends to be very CPU intensive. So with Silverlight 5, if you are using H.264 videos, you can offload the work of decoding the frames from the CPU. That will not only decrease the load on the CPU, it will also produce a better playback experience for your users. So the sound effect class, low latency sound, how do you use it? Well, if you are building applications that have sound effects, rather than use a media element from this point forward, I would recommend that you do it this way. Notice that I create a sound effect object here, and I do that by calling the static from stream method on the sound effect class. This is not the only way to do this, but it's probably the way we'll do it the most often. What I've done in this project is put a little sound file named gong.wave, which presumably plays a gong sound, into my application, set its build action to content, then I'm loading it directly out of the zap, handing it off to that sound effect element which wraps it, and now when I want to play that sound effect, I simply call play. Not that much different from what I might have done with the media element, except for the fact that with low latency sound, there should be no perceptible delay between the time you call that method and the sound actually plays. As far as trick play goes, variable rate playback later with pitch correction in a media element, all you have to do to leverage it is use the new playback rate property of the media element control, as I'm doing right here. Now, I have built a trick play demo. It only partially works since audio pitch correction isn't there yet. I'm going to show it to you, and once you get a public build that does audio pitch correction, I would encourage you to run this again because it's going to be a lot more dazzling then. But we're going to run it anyway. So, little story here. Back in my college days, I played a lot of rock and roll guitar. I still do it sometimes. I'm a little embarrassed by it because I'm not very good at it. I can make a lot of noise if the amp is powerful enough, but in my college days, when I was playing a lot of guitar, I used to spend hours and hours and hours sitting in front of record player with albums. Do any of you remember albums? You know, when I use the word album instead of CD, my kids laugh at me. So I try to use CDs, but we used albums back in those days. And to figure out all the cool little leads that the guitarists for, you know, Led Zeppelin and Jimi Hendrix and all these other guys were playing, I would just listen to these little looping tracks over and over and try to figure out the fingerings and how they're bending the strings and all. If only I had had Silverlight, my life would have been so much better because we could have done something like this. You know, kids today who are learning to play guitar, they just don't have it as tough as we did in the old days. So tell me if you can identify this song. One of the greatest rock and roll songs of all time. Free conference pass if you can name it. Actually, you don't need a free conference pass. It's too late, isn't it? Who knows what this is? Yeah, it is Jimi Hendrix. What's the name of the song? Voodoo Child. Yes, sir. We have a good developer right here. Now watch this. Now, suppose I'm trying to learn how to do this. You know, it'd be really nice if I could slow this down and I could really analyze those finger movements. So I'm just going to move this slider, change the playback rate property to 0.5. Now it all goes to slow motion. You'll notice right now in the beta, the sound stops. In the next public build, or at least sometime before this is released, the sound will not stop. It will continue playing, and thanks to audio pitch correction, it will not be distorted. So, One of the first things I'm going to build with this is something that lets today's guitar players learn how to do the fingerings more easily than we did it back in the old days. Now, I love that song so much. I could stop the session now and we could just listen to Jimi Hendrix the rest of the way, but I figure that's probably not why you're here. So let's go back to PowerPoint here for just a moment. Remember, we're starting with a little stuff and we're building up. Now, here's something else you should know about. In fact, this is one of those things that I think probably won't get a whole lot of press and a whole lot of attention, but it may be one of the enhancements to the runtime that impact you more than any other. It's one of those that's under the hood, it's hidden. And that is a couple of fundamental changes to the threading architecture of the Silverlight runtime. The big one is this. Silverlight, up through version 4, distinguishes between two types of threads. There's the UI thread, which it borrows from the browser, and on which Silverlight does most of its work. Rendering is done on the UI thread in Silverlight 4. Animations are run on the UI thread. It's always been a dictum for Silverlight developers to never enter any long-running loops on the UI thread, because if you do and you have animations running, those animations pause because Silverlight can't be doing something on the UI thread itself while you're on the UI thread. Another reason that we like to avoid those long-running loops on the UI thread is that while you're in that loop, Silverlight can't render. You may be in a big for loop adding objects to the visual tree, to the XAML DOM. But until you get out of that for loop and hand control of that UI thread back to Silverlight, none of the changes that you've made can be actually rendered out. Well, that's still the case in Silverlight 5. That is, we should still avoid long-running loops on the UI thread. But Silverlight 5 introduces a new thread to the runtime called the composition thread. This is actually a trick that Silverlight borrows from Silverlight for Windows Phone, which has been doing this since version 1, or maybe I should say version 7. What is a composition thread? It is a thread that is created if and only if you enable GPU acceleration in your application. If it's a browser-based application, that means you add that param element that sets enable GPU acceleration to true. Good interview question here. Does the composition thread even exist if GPU acceleration is not enabled? The answer is no. So step one is to enable GPU acceleration. Then what happens? Any animations that are manipulating parts of the visual tree that are being GPU cached will now execute on the composition thread rather than the UI thread. Now, the UI thread will still be called upon to rasterize the cached part of the visual tree one time to create the bitmap to hand off to the GPU. But once that's done, any further interactions, especially those being driven by animations, will be done on the GPU thread. Now, what does that mean to you, the developer? It does not mean that you can enter long-running loops on the UI thread, but what it does mean is that to the extent you're using the GPU and leveraging the composition thread, Silverlight will have more time on the UI thread to render changes to the XAML DOM, to be more responsive to user input. So it's a subtle change, but it is one that is going to make all of us like Silverlight applications a little bit better. Now, I want to show you a demonstration here, but first let me show you how you leverage the composition thread. Here's a very simple example in which I'm declaring a rectangle in XAML. You'll notice up at the top, I'm also setting its cache mode property to bitmap cache. That, of course, is how we ask the Silverlight runtime to render this into a block of pixels one time and hand it off to the GPU for further manipulations. You'll notice that I've also attached a rotate transform to this rectangle so that I can spin it around, and an animation, a double animation, which I'm using to vary the angle property of the rotate transform and literally make this rotate transform spin round and round. Because I am GPU caching this rectangle, and because the rectangle is being animated, this will automatically be handed off to the composition thread in Silverlight 5. Now, I have an example I want to show you. It's not easy to come up with a sexy way to show off threads, but there is one very good way that I know of to show the composition thread in action. So I'm going to open up a little project here called Composition Thread Demo. And I'm going to run it. Before I run it, I'm going to let you know, if you're pregnant, you may want to turn away. I made a pregnant lady sick recently by showing this demo because I've got things spinning round and round. If you have vertigo, you may want to close your eyes as well. So, hopefully I won't make anyone sick. I originally built this demo to show off GPU caching way back in the days of Silverlight 3. I've got a penguin that's spinning round and round. He's being continually rotated and scaled up and down. He is 50% transparent, which means that 60 times a second, Silverlight is trying to alpha blend the pixels in the penguin with this gradient background. I specifically designed this to stress the CPU. And in fact, you'll find on most machines, if you don't hand this off to the GPU, you'll use up to half of the available CPU just to drive this silly animation. But then you hand it off to the GPU, and CPU utilization usually drops to 1 or 2%. But I want you to watch this. I'm going to click inside this window. And I've got a simple mouse left button down handler that's going to run that calls thread.sleep on the UI thread to put the UI thread to sleep for 2 seconds. You saw the animation pause. Let me do it one more time in case you missed that. The animation pauses for 2 seconds. Here's what's going on. Right now, this application is running Silverlight 4 style. I have not enabled GPU acceleration, so there is no composition thread. Everything's being done on the UI thread, including that animation. So when I call thread.sleep on the UI thread, there's no way that animation can continue running because Silverlight is trying to animate on the UI thread as well. But we're going to change that. I'm going to go into the HTML test page that accompanies this application right here, and I'm going to change false to true on enable GPU acceleration right here. And if you look over in mainpage.xaml, you'll find that I've already added cache mode equals bitmap cache to this penguin user control. You can see it being done with property element syntax right there. So number one, I've enabled GPU acceleration. Number two, I've told the Silverlight runtime that I want this penguin rendered into a bitmap once and handed off to the GPU. That should automatically now take advantage of that composition thread in Silverlight 5. Let's see if that's true. You know, I can tell you these things all day unless I demo them for you. I could be making it all up, right? So to prove I'm not making this up, I'm going to click. And you'll just have to believe me that I really did click. Or maybe I'll pull a random person from the audience, and you may still not believe me. By the way, I posted my birth certificate online just before this session, in case you wondered. So I click, and I click, and I click, and that animation is not pausing. Why? Because that animation is now running on the composition thread. Subtle change, but a very welcome change. As far as composition is concerned, Silverlight for the desktop is now up to par with Silverlight for the phone. Good thing. And a good thing to know about. By the way, there are other ways to leverage the GPU. Towards the end of this presentation, I'm going to show you the new 3D API in Silverlight 5. One thing you should know is when you use this new drawing surface control to present a 3D drawing surface to the user, there's an event fired by that control named draw. When that event fires, your draw handler is executed on the composition thread, not the UI thread. So in this case right here, we weren't actually writing the code that runs on the composition thread. Silverlight was providing that code. But when you're using the new 3D API, you are actually writing code that's running on the composition thread, which makes some very, very interesting things possible even beyond 3D. All right, let's go back here. What else might we get into here? How about some data binding improvements? So, data binding has been around in Silverlight for a while now, and with each version of Silverlight, it gets better and better. The delta between data binding in Silverlight and WPF becomes smaller and smaller. Well, that delta shrinks again in Silverlight 5. In fact, we can even do some cool things here that I believe we cannot do, at least one of these, in WPF. The first of the enhancements to the data binding story is something called the implicit data template. I'm showing a very simple example of that here, but here's what it's all about. Let's say you're using a list box or some other items control to present content to a user. You're data binding a collection of items, a collection of objects to that list box, and you're using a data template to tell it how you want each of those items rendered into XAML. In the past, you could only have one data template associated with each item's control. But it's not that uncommon for that collection that we bind to an item's control to contain instances of different types. We may have, for example, if we're presenting an audio and video collection to a user, we may have a class named audio, which represents audio objects, and a class named video, which represents video objects. With this new feature, implicit data templates, we can associate multiple data templates with one item's control and associate each of those data templates with a different type of item we're binding to. So in this example, if you assume that I am binding to a collection that contains both audio objects and video objects with two implicit data templates, I'm telling the runtime, here's how I want to render an audio object into XAML, and here's how I want to render a video object into XAML. So it gives me additional latitude in telling an items control through data templates precisely how I want it to render the items that I hand off to it through binding into XAML. Something else that I think Silverlight developers will welcome is a richer relative source attribute in data binding. I believe it was Silverlight 4, they finally introduced relative source templated parent. In WPF for years, we've been able to use relative source find ancestor to walk up the visual tree to find an element to bind to. Now we can do the same thing in Silverlight. In this example right here, I have a simple grid with four ellipses inside it. Two of those ellipses, I've hard-coded a fill color, red and yellow. But look at the ellipse in the lower left corner of that grid. Notice it has the same color as that blue grid that is its parent. Why is that? If you look right here, I've said in the binding statement, relative source equals relative source ancestor type equals grid. That causes Silverlight to go up the visual tree to find the first grid and now take the fill color of this ellipse from the background color of that grid. But look what I've done in the next example here. I've also data bound the fill property of an ellipse to the background property of a grid. And once more, I've written relative source ancestor type equals grid, but I've added ancestor level equals 2. That tells the runtime to walk up the visual tree to bypass the first grid that it finds and to find the second grid. Well, that second grid has a background color of white, so the color, the fill color of that ellipse now is white as well. Again, it's just a way of closing the gap between WPF and Silverlight. This is something that has been a fairly common feature request from customers, and I'm glad to see that it's in the runtime now. Here's something else that's important, and something that I'm going to demo for you in just a moment. It's called style data binding or data bound style setters, depending on who you talk to. In Silverlight, you've never been allowed to define a style and to data bind the value property of that style to something else. Now you are allowed to use data binding inside your styles. In this example here, I've declared in XAML an instance of a class named ColorTheme, where presumably I'm storing some theming information for my application. Then I data bind a style to a property in that ColorTheme instance. And the cool thing about that is, assuming ColorTheme implements iNotify property changed, if I now go in at runtime and change the value of that property in the ColorTheme class, the style that is acquiring that property value through data binding will change too. Bottom line, while it's not the only way to do dynamic theming in Silverlight, it probably makes it easier than it has ever been to do dynamic theming. And that's why I want to show it to you here in just a moment. Before I do that, I want to mention this as well. One of the most talked about features of Silverlight 5 is something called data binding debugging, also known as XAML debugging, although that title is just a little bit misleading. One of the most frustrating things about using data binding in Silverlight has always been that if you have syntactical errors, generally you don't get any kind of indication other than it just doesn't work, right? Well, now you can put breakpoints in XAML, and when something is going wrong, you can see what's going wrong. You can step through the code. Now, this does not apply to XAML in general. Right now, you can only set breakpoints on binding statements. But this does set the stage for perhaps even richer XAML debugging in the future. Regardless, this is something I've wanted for a long time. It's been on the wish list of a lot of developers. And when things are going wrong in declarative XAML around those data binding statements, this makes it easier than ever before for you to figure out what's going wrong. So let's take a look and see if we can see some of this stuff in action. I want to open another sample project here named Style Data Binding Demo. And I'm going to run it. I built this demo to demonstrate how to use style data binding to do dynamic theming in Silverlight 5. Right now, you see a display that is kind of like the dark theme on a Windows phone. You see a gradient background that goes from black to blue, some blue text, etc. I'm going to click it one time and change to something else inspired by the Windows phone, a light theme with an orange accent color. Now, again, it's not that you couldn't do this in Silverlight 4. There were ways to do it. You could, with enough work, even do it back in Silverlight 3. But I would tell you it probably has never been easier than it is now in Silverlight 5. Let me show you what I mean. In this example, I began by defining a little CLR class or C-sharp class named ColorTheme, in which I'm going to store all the theme information that I want for this app. You'll notice that I did implement iNotifyPropertyChanged because since it's going to be the data source in a data binding scenario, I want to make sure that if I change a property of this ColorTheme object, that the binding object will propagate the new value over to the data target. Very simple to do. I also built into this color theme class some properties with names like background color and accent color and things like that. Notice I'm firing property changed events in the setters for those properties. I even built in a little helper method, a public method named toggle colors, which can toggle me between the dark theme and the light theme simply by changing the values of those properties in the color theme class. Then, in app.xaml, pretty much as I did in the slide, I declared an instance of that color theme class. Then, in the styles that I defined to assign visual attributes to the elements in my XAML, notice I'm using style data binding. I'm saying, for example, that when I assign a text element, the normal text style, I want the foreground property of that text to come from the text brush property of this color theme object right up here. Now, actually getting the themes to change was no more difficult than doing this. When I clicked, I reached into the current application object, found the resource name theme, cast it to a color theme object, called that toggle colors method you saw, which again does nothing more than change the values of those properties. So now, if dynamic theming is something that interests you, you have a different way to do it, arguably an easier way to do it than you've ever had before. Now, what about all this XAML debugging stuff? Does that really work, or is Microsoft just pulling our leg? Well, let's find out. I'm going to go back. Let's just choose one here, something that does some data binding. Text overflow demo may be good because you recall I was using data binding in there to bind the value properties of a pair of slider controls to properties of a rich text box. So what I'm going to do here is this. Let's go into this first slider control. This is the one that I've bound to the font size. And let's do something with it. In fact, we should be able to find the data binding right here. Yes, here's why I'm binding the font size property of the rich text box to the value property of the slider. That's why when I slid the slider thumb back and forth, you saw the size of the text change. Let's say that that's broken. Maybe while we were typing this out, we mistyped the name of that property, or maybe, you know, we forgot that it's value and not val. So what's going to happen when I rerun this thing? Well, we don't get any error messages. We don't get any indication that anything is wrong. But lo and behold, if I move that slider thumb back and forth, the font size is no longer changing. So clearly I have something wrong. On pre-Silverlight 5 now, I'm left to my own devices, right? I'll bet a lot of you have been in this situation before. But watch what I'm going to do now. I have to get ready for this. This brings a tear to my eye sometimes, and I don't want to cry in front of an audience. But I can now put a breakpoint. Oh, Give me a minute. Whew. Isn't that good stuff? And now watch this. When I press the magic F5, we break into XAML. And look at this, folks. Binding state. It says error system.exception, val property not found. Now I know what's wrong. How about that? All I have to do to fix this is go right back in here, change that to value, and it should work again. I mean, isn't it just beautiful? Maybe you're not as impressed with it as I am, but I really like that feature. Let's see what else we can get ourselves into, though. Yes, sir. What? Oh, it's not breaking down because I did a control F5 rather than an F5. Yeah, that's totally undocumented, so don't share that, okay? Don't tweet it, don't blog it. I'm just kidding. How about custom markup extensions? Something else that has been requested a lot of the Silverlight team over time. What is a markup extension? It is an extension to the XAML language. When you're writing XAML and you come across an expression in curly braces, that is a markup extension. So Silverlight has supported a small set of markup extensions for a long time. There's static resource, binding, a few others. But unlike WPF, Silverlight has never allowed us to write custom markup extensions. This has the potential to be one of the most important features added to the runtime in this version, I think, because it gives us an extensibility point finally for XAML so that we can build markup extensions of our own. Now, how do you do that, and why do you care to do it? Well, here's one example. If you use the MVVM pattern in your Silverlight applications, you have probably had to either bring in third-party frameworks like the MVVM-like toolkit or used stuff from Blend like system.windows.interactivity.dll to implement commanding support. In Silverlight 4, for example, buttons have a command property that you can bind to a property in the view model that executes some command, some action when clicked. But the list box doesn't have that property. So we end up relying on third-party frameworks to get that MVVM support that we need. I actually pulled this little example out of one of the SDK examples. How about this? How about a custom markup extension called method invoke that you can use to connect any property, any command from your view model to an event on any control in Silverlight? This is really, really cool stuff. And the source code for that method invoke markup extension is right there in the SDK. And I'm going to show you another use for this in my next demo. But first, let me describe to you how you write one of these custom markup extensions. And it doesn't have to be difficult. Sometimes they get a little hairy, but sometimes they're almost trivial to write. What you do is derive from the markup extension class, a new base class in Silverlight 5, as I've done here. That base class has just one method named provide value. You override that method, and when the XAML parser needs you to evaluate that markup extension, it calls your provide value method. Now, in this very simple example, I call this the hello markup extension. I just take the value inside that markup extension, add the text hello to it, or prepend hello, and then return that. So, with this markup extension, if I use it this way, notice text blocks text equals, my custom markup extension text equals Silverlight 5, what gets returned is hello Silverlight 5. And all I had to do was derive from that markup extension base class. Now, where does that text property of the markup extension came from? It's there, and the XAML parser recognizes it because if you go back a slide, in fact, let me just do that for you. I built a public property named text into the markup extension. This is how you define those named parameters that can be used with your markup extension. You simply build public properties like this one right here into the markup extension base class. Now, sometimes markup extensions really are this simple. Sometimes they're not. If I go back again to this slide, you may notice that that provide value method receives a reference to something called an iService provider. There are times when your markup extension needs help from the runtime to do the things it needs to do. If, for example, you were building your own custom version of Silverlight's binding markup extension, you would need a way to get access to the target of that binding, to the target object, and probably to a target property. If you were going to go further and implement the element name parameter of the built-in binding markup extension, you would need some way to call out into the runtime, give it the name of a XAML element, and let it return to you a reference to the actual object in the visual tree with that name. That's what that iService provider interface is for. What I can do in Silverlight is call that interface's getService method. It's the only method in the interface. And I can ask for an iProvideValue target if I want to reach out from my extension into the object that is the target of this thing. Or I can ask for an iXAML type resolver if I want to resolve a XAML element name into a CLR object instance reference. I can even ask for an iRoot object provider if I want to walk up the visual tree and find out where the root of that tree is. Here's a simple example of that. In this markup extension, I'm calling getService to ask the runtime for an iProvideValue target interface, and I'm simply then pulling out the name of the property to which this markup extension has been applied, and yes, the property type as well. So if I wrote text block text equals my custom markup extension in this case, if I put a breakpoint in here, I would see that the property name that I'm bound to is text, and the property type is string, and the property name is text. Let me show you one way I think developers will use this, especially you developers over here in Europe. Now, you know how it is in the U.S. We just assume that everyone in the world speaks English, and then we act surprised when we find out that they don't. You want to scare a U.S. developer? Wait till he gets the app all built and tested out and then say, where's the localization support? You can literally cause people to run screaming out the door when you do that. Well, how about this? Instead of some of the hacks we've used in XAML in the past with data binding to bind XAML elements to localization resources, how about an easy-to-use custom markup extension to do that localization? That's exactly what I've done in this application right here. Let me run it for you. So you can see clearly originally the culture here is set to French. I pray that bienvenue means welcome in French. I took French all through high school. I probably don't know 20 words today. Does this mean welcome in French? Yes. But suppose that you don't speak French. Maybe some of you in here don't. What about this? What I'm going to do is go over into app.xaml.cs. I'm going to comment out the line of code that creates the culture info object for the French culture and assigns it to the current thread. Now I'll be using my default localization resources, which are in English, so I would expect to see the word welcome here with a United States flag. Now, there's nothing entirely remarkable about this. A lot of you have done localization in Silverlight before, but you've probably never done it exactly the way I'm doing it here because I'm doing no data binding to make this happen. If you look at the project, I do have ResX files with localization resources for English, for French, for Spanish, and for German. But if you look in mainpage.xaml, this is where things get kind of interesting. Because for that text block, for example, that says welcome in different languages, here is that text block, here is its text property, and look at this, a custom markup extension named ResX. I have built into that custom markup extension public properties, which gives me support for named parameters named ResX key, ResX type, and default. ResX type is simply the name of the Visual Studio generated resource manager wrapper class that's generated from my ResX files. ResX key is the name of the resource itself inside the ResX. And if you want, you can optionally use this default parameter to specify the text that should appear there if for some reason my custom markup extension is unable to load the resource that you've asked for. So cleaner, I believe, than using data binding. And because you now have control over it, you could build in all kinds of cool support for features right here in that markup extension that Silverlight doesn't offer to you out of the box. So what does that markup extension look like? It's actually surprisingly simple. The source code is right here. You can see that I have derived from the markup extension base class. No surprise there. I've built in three public properties, lending support for those three named parameters you saw me use. And then I've overridden the provide value method. And basically all I do when it's called is use reflection to create an instance of the Visual Studio generated resource manager wrapper class, which you identified through the ResX type key. And then I use a little more reflection to go get the value of the property that you specified with the ResX key parameter. Couldn't be a whole lot simpler than that. And you can see that it actually works. Just one of many, many, many uses I'm sure that developers like you are going to find for custom markup extensions. But here's the cool part, folks. It just gets better and better the deeper you dig into Silverlight 5. Some of the biggest news regarding the product has to do with trusted applications. Now, you may recall that back in Silverlight 3, that was the first version of Silverlight to support out-of-browser applications. But in that day and time, there was no functional difference, really, between an out-of-browser app and an in-browser app. While an out-of-browser app did run in its own process in its own window, it enjoyed no more or no fewer privileges than an in-browser app. But that changed some in Silverlight 4 when they introduced the trusted application. A trusted application in Silverlight 4 had to run outside the browser. And it wasn't really trusted in the sense that we normally think of trust. It ran in a larger sandbox than an in-browser app, but it was not totally outside of the sandbox. Well, they've enhanced this trusted model even more. Number one, in Silverlight 5, you can now run trusted applications inside the browser, a huge feature request from Microsoft customers. Now, there are some permissions that you or a system administrator have to set up to enable that to happen. I'm going to show you what those are in just a moment. But you can also now do multiple windows in a trusted out-of-browser application. I'll show you an example of that in just a moment. It's very easy to do. It's also very easy to send messages between the windows so that they can communicate with one another. There's even an API for enumerating the windows that your application has opened. And finally, no more limitations as to what parts of the file system a trusted application can access. In Silverlight 4, a trusted application could access some parts of the file system, the so-called My folders in Windows, like My Documents, My Videos, My Pictures, My Music. But it was impossible to reach out to other parts of the file system if you were a trusted app unless you went through a Calm automation interface to do it. Well, the team looked at that and they said, you know what, it's kind of silly. We shouldn't be forcing people to write Calm automation classes just to get out to the file system. So the file system limitations are waived for trusted applications in Silverlight 4. Now, let's look at some examples and also a few details. Trusted applications in the browser. I said that there's some permissions that have to be set up to allow this to happen. The permissions involve the registry, and they involve the certificate store on the user's machine. Now, these are not permissions that you would expect your users to set up. What Microsoft was thinking was, we'll do this through group policy. You're a system administrator at your company. You want all the Silverlight users to be able to run trusted apps in their browser. You push out a policy that will make these changes. The changes are this. Number one, in order to run a trusted application in the browser, you have to add a new entry to the registry. The exact path varies depending on whether it's 32-bit or 64 windows, but that value is named allow elevated trust apps in browser. In addition, the ZAP in which that trusted application is housed must be signed. Now, you recall, in Silverlight 4, you were encouraged, even compelled, to sign trusted applications, but you were not required to do so. You are now required to sign your trusted apps if you intend for them to run inside the browser. And in addition, the certificate used to sign that ZAP must be installed in the trusted publisher's store on that client machine. Again, not something you'll expect your users to do, something that you'll probably implement through policy. One nice piece of news for you developers out there is that these restrictions are waived if the Zap is downloaded from local hosts. That means you can test and debug a trusted in-browser application without signing the Zap, without setting registry keys, even without installing anything in your own trusted publisher's certificate store. But these do summarize the two changes that are required for elevated or trusted apps to be run inside the browser when they're not coming from local hosts. At the top, you see in my registry, you can see that I've added that allow elevated trust apps in browser value, set it to 1. At the bottom, you're looking in the certificate store of the machine on which I took the snapshot, specifically looking inside the trusted publisher's certificate store. And to make sure that this user can run these trusted apps in browser, any trusted apps signed with this certificate, I've installed the certificate right there. Now, there is one other twist to this that you should know about. Is it possible, now that we can run trusted apps in the browser, is it possible to set up a policy that would allow the users at your company to run trusted apps in the browser, but to not allow them to install those trusted applications as out-of-browser apps on their machines? Well, it's possible that some customers will want that. So Microsoft thought about that too, and there is another registry key that's not as well documented, but that you can add if you want. It's called allow install of elevated trust apps. If you set it to 0, trusted apps can be run inside the browser, assuming that other registry key is present as well, but this will prevent a user from installing or even running an out-of-browser application. Now, this is not documented yet, but the absence of this key is interpreted by the Silverlight runtime to mean that you will allow trusted applications to be installed as OOBs. So if you specifically want to forbid that, you must add this to the registry on the user's machine. And by the way, there will be some tooling support to help you out with this later on. Now, here's another one of those slides that makes some people cry. I'm going to try again not to. Take a look at this code. I am enumerating the files in the System32 directory. Couldn't do that in Silverlight 4, but when you're a trusted app in Silverlight 5, remember restrictions on the parts of the file system you can access are waived. Now, did I have a reason for doing this? No, I can't think of a reason in the world to want to enumerate the files in that directory, but I did it just because I can, and sometimes that's reason enough. Let's look at an example. Actually, before that, let's talk about multiple windows. When you are an out-of-browser app in Silverlight 5 and you're a trusted application, you now have the ability to create multiple windows. This slide, this piece of code here, shows how to do that. What I do very simply is I create a new window object, something that you couldn't do in Silverlight 4. Then I set various properties on that window to specify its dimensions and where on the screen I want it to appear. I even set its title. The window class has a new title property, by the way. You can't set it on the main window, at least not yet, but you can set it on the additional windows that you create. And then ultimately, when you set the visibility property of that new window object to visibility.visible, it will appear on the screen and become visible to the user. Of course, you'll probably want to put something in that window as well. And the way you do this is patterned after the way you declared or defined content for notification windows in Silverlight 4. What we typically do is we create a user control. We craft the user control so that it looks exactly like what we want to present in this new window. And then we create an instance of that user control and assign the reference to the window's content property. That now becomes the content of that window. And here's something else you can do, and a little shout out here. I don't know where you are, but I think you're here, Mike Talty. I didn't know this until I read this from your blog. There's even a way to enumerate windows, because in the application class in Silverlight 5, there's a new property named Windows. If you want to enumerate all the windows in your app, you can do as I'm doing here. If you want to know which one is the main window, because this enumeration does include the main window, and which ones are not, you can do this simple comparison that I'm showing right here. Now, let's see it in action. Because remember, if I don't show you this, I could be pulling your leg. So I want to open one named multi-window demo. And here's what it looks like when it runs. Now, my other window has There we go. Almost disappeared there. So the main window is the big one. But the moment it started up, it created a child window, this one right here. And you can see that it's a real Windows window. It's not something we're faking with something inside the browser. Whoops, didn't mean to do that. Ooh, wrong one. Oh, it's not a browser window. It's this one. There we go. To demonstrate one technique for passing messages between the windows, I've set this one up so that when you click on one of these images, it fires a message containing the URI of the thumbnail that was clicked over to the main window, which can show an enlarged view of that image. So, let me show you how easy it was to build this application. And although I only created one additional window here, you can create as many as you want. There's no artificial limit on that. So let's pop back into Visual Studio here for just a moment and take a look at some code. So, first in mainpage.xaml.cs. And by the way, you have to be a trusted out-of-browser application to create additional windows. It doesn't work if you're not trusted. It also doesn't work if you're an in-browser application, even if you are trusted. This only works with trusted out-of-browser applications. When my application starts up in mainpage.xaml.cs, I do pretty much what you saw on the slides. I create a new window, which I simply call pop-up. I give it a width and a height. In terms of positioning it, I'm actually basing it on the position of the main window so that it sits above the main window and is perfectly centered inside it. I specify what the title should be in that new window, and then I create a user control named Pictures User Control to represent the content inside it and assign it to the content property of the window object. Finally, I make it visible to the user right here. Now, what does that Pictures User Control look like? It's just another user control. This is where I'm displaying those little child images or thumbnail images that you saw. And there's not a whole lot to it. It's just plain old XAML. Got a grid control with four columns of equal width. And I'm putting a thumbnail image in each one of those. Very simple to do. Now, where does the messaging come in? One of the things that I thought about when I was building this was, why don't I use local connections to allow these windows to communicate with each other? And I actually wrote a version that did that. And then I thought, you know what? That's really heavyweight. Local connections are really for inter-process communication. Isn't there an easier way to simply pass messages back and forth between the windows in this app? Well, of course there is. When I thought about it just a little bit, let me show you what I did. Couldn't be a whole lot simpler. In app.xaml.cs, I defined an event in my application class named ImageSelected. I also added a public method named RaiseImageSelectedEvent. So now, in that child window, when a thumbnail is clicked and I want to communicate the URI of the image that was clicked over to the main window, my child window simply does this. Let's go take a quick look at the code. That'll be in picturesusercontrol.xaml.cs. Right here it is. When one of those thumbnails is clicked, I reach into the application, find the instance of my app class, call its RaiseImageSelectedEvent, and fire off that image URI in the event. And over in mainpage.xaml.cs, when the application starts up in the main window, I register a handler for those image selected events and just use a simple lambda expression here to set the source property of the main image in the main window equal to the URI of the thumbnail that was clicked, which is coming in that event args right there. Very simple mechanism, easier than local connections, more efficient as well. And I did that simply to demonstrate how you can make these windows communicate once you create them. All right. One of the biggest pieces of news in Silverlight 5 is a whole brand new sparkling 3D graphics subsystem. This too has been something that the Silverlight team has received numerous feature requests for over the years. It's something that's been on their radar screen for a long time, but in previous versions simply didn't make the cut because, you know, like every development team on the planet, They began a new version with a long list of features that they would like to have, but then real life intervenes and they end up having to pare it down to the features they consider the most important. This feature finally made the cut, so we have a real high-performance GPU-accelerated 3D graphics engine in Silverlight 5. If you haven't seen this yet, there's one aspect of it that may surprise you. A lot of folks assume that if Silverlight ever gained full 3D support, that the model it used would be based on the WPF 3D model. But in fact, that's not the case. It's actually using the XNA 3D engine. Now, is that a departure from the norm? Arguably not, because if you've written code for Silverlight for Windows Phone, you know that it supports 3D XNA. In fact, in the future, I think it's likely Microsoft will kind of gather more around the XNA 3D API than the old WPF 3D API. This is one piece of evidence to support that. If you are already an Xbox programmer, you're going to feel right at home with this API because that's really where it comes from. If you're a 3D programmer who have used other languages like Direct3D or OpenGL, this is a little bit different from those, but you're going to catch on pretty quickly. If you've never done 3D before, it's going to take a little bit of time to come up to speed on this, but already there are some good tutorials, articles, and things coming out. In fact, I am planning later this spring, hopefully a good series of tutorials digging deep out into this API myself. But before you do anything with a 3D API, you must do this. You must enable GPU acceleration, which you would do this way if this thing is going to run in browser. Why is that? 3D is too much for a CPU. When you look at models containing perhaps tens of thousands of polygons forming a polygonal mesh or model, and you look at backface culling and shading and lighting and stuff, CPUs aren't designed to handle that. GPUs are. In fact, there is no software rendering support for 3D in Silverlight. If the machine does not have a GPU in it, and if it doesn't have a shader model 2.0 compatible GPU, which happens to be a fairly low bar, by the way, then you cannot do 3D in Silverlight. The vast, vast majority of machines being used out there today do have a GPU that's at least capable of supporting shader model 2.0. Step number one in using this API, enable GPU acceleration. If you want to know whether you can do 3D on this machine, one way to find out is to use this little piece of code right here. I'm asking the Silverlight runtime, specifically something called a graphics device, what the render mode is. And if it tells me render mode is hardware, that means that, yes, Silverlight has found a GPU that you can use. The other possible value of render mode is unavailable, which tells you that Silverlight has not found a GPU that it can use on this machine. There's even a property named render mode reason that you can use to get more information about that when Silverlight says, I don't think I can do anything on this machine. Fortunately, on any machine probably less than 2 or 3 years old, this is never going to be an issue. Even a lot of older machines will support it as well. Once you've enabled GPU acceleration, the next step in using this new 3D API is to declare a drawing surface, or multiple drawing surfaces if you want. This is a new control in Silverlight 3. The drawing surface is literally a canvas upon which you can project 3D objects. Now, you can dimension it just like any other XAML element. In fact, it is a XAML element. But perhaps the most important thing to know about this thing is that it fires an event named draw. When you declare a drawing surface, you register a handler for that event, and it's in that handler that you draw whatever you want to into that drawing surface. Now, what I've shown here on this slide is kind of the basic strategy that we go about in implementing a draw event handler. I should have probably put a nice diagram of the 3D rendering pipeline in here, but I did not, so I'm going to have to talk through this. But this code here does demonstrate the basic steps required to use this pipeline. I first call clear on the graphics device. That basically clears out the pixel buffer, the back buffer in which I'm going to be doing this 3D rendering. I then call set vertex buffer. I'll say more about this on the next slide, but as in most 3D graphics subsystems, the way you define what you want the to draw is by defining lots and lots and lots of little polygons. In this system, typically triangular polygon meshes. And you connect them together to form a model of whatever it is that you want to draw. It's with this called the set vertex buffer that you're informing the GPU and the 3D runtime about all the polygons and all of their vertices that you're going to ask it to render out, to shade, to do backface culling on, and things like that. Then you call a method named setVertexShader. This pipeline relies on two types of shaders, vertex shaders, which basically transform local coordinates of the vertices into coordinates complete with color and texture information, and pixel shaders, which are used to actually generate the pixels for the faces that aren't culled from the model that you've handed off. In the beta, there are no built-in vertex and pixel shaders. You have to supply them yourself, and you have to write them in a language called HLSL, high-level shading language, which comes from the DirectX SDK. The good news is, in later versions of this, certainly before Silverlight 5 ships, there will be built-in vertex shaders and pixel shaders, so you won't have to do nearly the work that I'm having to do in some of my demos. But the cool thing is you'll always have the capability to define your own pixel and vertex shaders to really, really tap into that pipeline and control the way it does things. It's actually in the call to draw primitives that where the rendering is done. And then notice after I call draw primitives, I call the graphics device's invalidate surface method. Here is something that's very different about XNA3D on the Xbox and XNA3D in Silverlight. On the Xbox, that draw event is timer driven. Silverlight, it is not. This draw method is called one time and one time only, unless in it you call invalidate surface, causing it to be fired again. There's also a method named invalidate you can call from outside the drawing surface to force another call to draw, but you need to realize this is not timer driven like the Xbox is. You have to call invalidate surface whenever you want another draw event to fire. That does mean this event might fire at different intervals on different machines. To help with that, the event args passed to the draw method contains timing information, a delta time value and a total time value that you can use to make animations you might be performing, for example, run at exactly the same speed on different devices. An undocumented aspect of this, by the way, is that this draw event does synchronize with the monitor's refresh rate. If your code is good enough and efficient enough to execute 60 or more times per second, if you call invalidate surface each time draw is called, you'll see it executing exactly 60 times a second. I'm sure that will be documented later on. Quick tutorial on 3D models. Not news to you if you've done 3D programming before. Generally, in this API, the way we build the model is we define all the vertices for a set of triangles that define the model. Those vertices have X, Y, and Z coordinates. In this simple example here, I've defined a polygonal mesh that looks something like a dolphin. I can now pass that off to the GPU with set vertex buffer and ask Silverlight to render it for me. And I've got a little bit of code in here as well, just showing how to do a few more things. In this example, I'm setting up those vertices, defining my model to keep it simple to fit it on one slide. I'm defining a one polygon model with different colors at each vertex. This code normally would appear outside your draw method because the resources that you're creating, if they're not changing over time, you don't want to recreate them over and over in the draw method. You want to create them outside and then just draw them in the draw method to make it as simple as possible. Vertex and pixel shaders, which today, again, have to be written by you in HLSL. I've got some sample ones in my project here, and there are some samples in the SDK. You then have to hand those off to the runtime so that it can use them in the pipeline. This is the code for doing that. And another thing you'll run into anytime you do 3D work is you have to tell the runtime certain things like, where's the camera position? How is the camera oriented? What is it looking at? And by the way, how should we handle perspective in the matrix transforms that are going to be done? What I'm doing here with these calls right here is defining a pair of matrices that have to be defined in your code and passed off to the runtime to tell it how to do these transformations. I'm basically setting up a view fulcrum with a near plane of 1 and a far plane of 100. So anything in between those planes is going to be rendered. Anything outside them is going to be clipped out. I'm also positioning the camera 5 units along the z-axis from the center of my model, and I'm asking the camera to be pointing at the origin, 000, and I'm asking for the camera's orientation around the z-axis to be straight up. Now, I've got a simple example. It's in the zip file that came with this session. I'll be building more of those, so I don't want to sound self-serving by doing this. My blog is not the most exciting in the world, but I will be publishing lots of cool 3D samples there in the future. But what I do want to show you is the best one I've seen so far. This one was just published a couple of weeks ago, I guess. The source code was published last week. It was shown at MIX. Any of us can download the source code and look at it. It's a 3D model that allows me to walk around, so I can do this. I can kind of walk around in here. I'm using the arrow keys, or I can spin around and things like that. You see a picture of Scott Guthrie right there. I can even walk over here, and I can climb these stairs. There are, it tells me right down here, over 80,000 active vertices in this model and more than 52,000 active polygons. Obviously, it's all being GPU rendered. This laptop that I'm running right now is not an overpowered one by any means. It's dual core, but it's a couple of years old, but you can see that the performance is quite good. Now, I don't know how many of you will be building things like this. How might you use 3D in a line of business app? Maybe you want to draw some pretty charts, some pretty graphs, or something like that. I don't know. You decide. I'm just really glad that this feature is in there finally. The URL, if you do a search on Babylon, Silverlight 5 Babylon, you will find the sample and the source code that goes with it. Pretty amazing stuff. Last thing here I want to mention, because we are almost out of time, is this. There are some features in the beta that I haven't mentioned, mostly because some of these don't lend themselves to really great demos. The Silverlight team in every version of Silverlight does quite a lot of hard work to make it faster, to make XAML parsing faster, to reduce startup times and things like that. This version is no exception. They've done a lot of stuff to try to make this as fast as possible and to reduce the startup time of an application. Also, the mouse button event args passed to most of your mouse event handlers now contains a click count property. So if you want to write a handler for double clicks instead of single clicks, all you have to do in, say, that mouse left button down handler is check the click count property to see if it's equal to 2. And there's some other little things as well. Now, what's not in the beta? Some of the most exciting new features of Silverlight 5 aren't there yet, but Microsoft has told us they will be there. In Silverlight 4, for example, which was the first version to support printing, you may have noticed printing is pretty slow in Silverlight 4 because even though what's on that printed page is probably mostly comprised of vectors and XAML, Silverlight is rasterizing all of that into a bitmap to send it out to the printer. In Silverlight 5, they're adding PostScript printing support. It should be pretty seamless. It should make things that you define in XAML print much, 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 much faster because instead of sending pixels out to the printer, they'll be sending PostScript vectors out to the printer. Something else that's coming is real native 64-bit support, and maybe the most talked about feature of all is support for pinvoke. Folks, you will finally be able, if you're a trusted application, to invoke native operating system services the same way you might have with pinvoke from ordinary .NET code. This door sort of began to crack open with trusted apps in Silverlight 4. Some of you may have heard of something called Nestle native extensions for Silverlight, basically a set of COM automation objects that allowed us to indirectly get to the OS. Now we'll be able to get to the OS directly using pinvoke. Not there in the beta, but will be available post-beta, as well as some other cool stuff as well. Microsoft has said publicly that the pivot control that we tend to use quite a lot in Silverlight for Windows Phone will be there in Silverlight 5 as well. So let me ask you, did you see anything that you liked here? Yeah, some cool new stuff, isn't there? Well, listen, go out and build some great Silverlight applications and hope to see you back in some of my sessions tomorrow. I'm going to put the URL up here again for the samples if you want to download them. Thank you very much.